Ladies and gentlemen, a week's gone by, a lot's gone on, which means it's time to tune in and listen to the ramblings of a diehard sports fan with Eli Gray.
Hey there, everybody. Good evening. Thank you for joining us on a day later than normally, but this week's episode of Ramblings of a Diehard Sports Fan. I'm Eli. I'm joined by our great producer and oftentimes co-host, Roger. Roger, how you doing?
Doing real well, Eli. Hey, great intro, buddy.
thank you, sir. It took a long time to get that one down. It's very complex there. Very complex there. And talking about how we're doing, I'm doing extraordinarily well because thank God we are once again at that time of the year where the pads are being strapped on and NFL camp is in the air, which means we're about a week and a half away from preseason games and a month or so away from the NFL regular season kicking off. And oh my God, it seems like forever, but oh my God, I'm so looking forward to NFL kicking up again.
Yeah, I hear you, Eli. I'm just as jazzed, dude. I am. This is the first time I'm going to be following it all the way through. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, and it's, training camp is that beautiful time where pretty much in the NFL, especially, you know, for a regular season at least, everyone's gearing up. You got some teams at the bottom that obviously we all know how it's going to turn out. But at the top of the crop, you know, the AFC, some of the middle of the pack, help themselves. Some teams that have been playing strong lately have lost some pieces. You know, the Steelers losing Mike Wallace, see how that affects them with losing their receiver. The Patriots losing some of their big pieces in the offense. You know, Hernandez obviously away. Gronkowski going to be out for a while. You know, their receiver core might be a little bit down. So the NFL, especially training camp, is going to have a lot to watch, the top teams. And, you know, we saw it today. The news is that Matt Ryan of the Atlanta Falcons got re-upped for a 5-year deal. So the Falcons lock up their signal caller like the Ravens did with Flacco after the Super Bowl. And I don't know if you got a chance to look at Ron Jaworski releases every year his list of top 32 quarterbacks. And unshockingly at all, he's got Aaron Rodgers at 1, Brady and Manning at number 2, Brady at 3. Some people think that should be switched. And shockingly, and it's obviously due to the Super Bowl win, Joe Flacco at number 4, Matt Ryan. You know, so the top of his list is fairly predictable. And, you know, the middle of the pack, and once again, it really shows the teams that make the playoffs and go deep, it's for one reason and one reason only, and that's where your season lies on is the quarterback. You know, the days of old where some teams had a strong defense and a mediocre quarterback can carry them. I'm thinking especially of the Ravens when they won their Super Bowl with Trent Dilfer. You know, those days are gone, especially the past few years, the way we're looking. You need a very strong quarterback. Otherwise, you are done. And so,
Eli, let me interrupt you there. Which Manning? I know it's an obvious question, but you said Manning is number 2. Which one? Are you talking about Eli or are you talking about Peyton?
So that's the interesting thing is he's got Peyton at 2 and Eli Manning is number 8. You know, Eli Manning, you know, Peyton has been great. You know, he's seamlessly transitioned into the Broncos. But it wouldn't shock me. You know, Eli Manning is one of those guys who, you know, even though Jaworski has him at 8, he doesn't get enough credit. He's been very solid with the Giants, even though he doesn't always have pieces with them. He's one of those guys that always get criticized and, you know, still a very, very good quarterback. But for right now, he's got Peyton at number 2. And you know, like I said, Brady at 3. The interesting thing with those two to me is they're getting older. You know, Brady hasn't been around as long, but he's still they're getting older. And at some point, the thing that I'm watching out for with those two, and maybe it's not this year, but you would have to think it's within the next few years, is they're going to hit a wall at some point. And how hard do they hit it with the age factor? And, you know, like I just mentioned, the Patriots, you know, especially looking at them from a Dolphins fan perspective. So, you know, they are I think, beatable this year. But obviously we've been saying that for a few years, and they prove us wrong. But it would seem that they are beatable this year because of the pieces they lost. They didn't add strong offensive pieces. And you would have to think at some point that system comes to a crash. But, you know, they keep proving us wrong each and every year. And it looks like, you know, the NFC has gotten much stronger. Teams that going into last season we didn't think would be good, you know, were very good. The Redskins with Robert Griffin, you have to watch how he acclimates and, you know, with the injury when he comes back. But NFL training camp, well in the, you know, into its first week, teams have already had practices with the pads. And, you know, soon enough, by the end of next week, we're already at, you know, preseason games. And it's going to be off and running, which is a good thing, especially since these past few weeks have been a downtime in sports overall. So what's your take on, you know, training camp starting and any interesting thoughts you might have on the NFL?
I appreciate that, Eli. If anything, I've been paying attention to the West Coast right now. It's been kind of quiet in San Diego, but up north in Oakland, man, there's a feeling up there in Oakland that the fans are not very happy because they've gotten rid of a lot of guys, and it's like a clean slate. So even the fans and me, as far as I am, a bit confused, don't know what's going to happen with the Raiders. I just know that right now San Francisco, Seattle, and San Diego, those teams are still – I know they're in different divisions, but they're still the big names on the West Coast. The Raiders, Eli – sorry, they're just not going to do anything. It's disappointing.
Yeah.
I'd rather see the Raiders good than bad, dude.
Yeah, and they're riding, you know, Carson Palmer, an aging quarterback who's still solid, I think, but, you know, aging, and you need to be grooming the next guy to take him over. And like you said, you know, they don't look like they're going to be that good. Kansas City was one of those teams, and I say this now, you know, obviously, the optimism in this is, though, they look like that team that could take a turnaround, sort of like the Dolphins did in 08, where they had the worst record in the league and then switched around off of the play of, you know, a new coach and Chad Pennington coming in. Andy Reid is now out there in Kansas City. They got themselves a quarterback. And, you know, that could be one of the sleeper teams that has a chance to really turn it around. Obviously, they're not going to overtake Denver because Denver, you know, still has Manning and has a very solid offense, and their defense was just as good last year too. But Kansas City could be a shocker team, especially in the West, where San Diego, like you said, you know, it looks optimistic, but you never know what you're going to get with them. And Oakland, I would venture to say they're going to be in last place. So Kansas City could be a team that you look at as a sleeper. And, you know, a lot of teams, you know, the AFC North is going to be a close match. You've got Pittsburgh and Baltimore always going neck and neck. The AFC South, you would have to think that it's going to come down to Indianapolis and Houston, and Tennessee and Jacksonville are just going to linger in the bottom. And, you know, all across the board, the NFL is going to have, just like it usually always does, some very good races all throughout the season, especially in the sport. The beauty of it is that each game really does mean something, and, you know, you want to come out of the gate churning, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see which teams are able to do that. You know, some teams are still going with the younger quarterbacks, and, you know, that's going to take them some time. Jake Locker in Tennessee might develop, but, you know, you would assume Tennessee stays towards the bottom. And a lot of teams, you know, eight new positions at coach, you know, QB turnover. Those are the things I'm looking at, how those teams that had the coaches turn around, you know, how they acclimate. But, you know, the NFC got so much better. You know, overall, the top of their, you know, the cream of the crop in the NFC is just, to me, so much better than the AFC. And you're going to have teams, I feel like we're going to have one or two teams in the NFC that are going to go 9-7, maybe even 10-6, who might not make the playoffs, as crazy as that sounds. Whereas in the AFC, you'll have a 9-7 team that's probably going to, you know, squeak in. But the NFC, I could see a 9-7 team for sure, maybe even a 10-6 team not making it, just due to the level of talent and the very good teams that you have in the NFC.
I agree, Eli. Not too long ago, we saw two teams fight out for the division lead, one of them St. Louis, when they were 7-9. That was disappointing, Eli. But one final thought, I agree with you with Kansas City. I think they drafted well enough to really turn it around, to be competitive. Maybe not necessarily dangerous, but I agree. Kansas City is going to be a team to pay attention to.
Yeah, so it's NFL, like I said, the games are right around the corner. The Hall of Fame game right around the corner. Just as soon as the camp starts up, it's almost crazy how you I always had the impression, and it was wrong, that camp beginning was much longer, but just as soon as it starts, you're almost right into the preseason games. A lot of players fighting it out. It's always, fun time to be following the NFL with position battles and whatnot. And the Rams, I don't know if you saw, the ESPN went out there and brought Google Glass. Those of you not familiar with the technology, Google Glass is something that, it's a little bit, it didn't really take off. Google was trying to get it. It's very pricey right now, but the technology, the concept behind it is very cool. It's a one-lens pair of glasses, but it has one lens, and you speak, and it controls different things. You can take video from perspective of what you're seeing, photos along those lines. ESPN brought Google Glass out to the Rams training camp and had Sam Bradford try it out, and it was interesting to see. You get a whole different perspective of what the quarterback is seeing, what the wide receiver is seeing, and the thought process is that maybe the NFL is going to start using that going forward. I think, especially today where fans are clamoring for anything, that could be, the way we see things going, especially if Google tweaks Glass like, we assume they would because they're trying to push it.
I tell you, Eli, seeing the video, and thank you for sending that to me, this is creative. This is almost like a video game, but it's real. You've thrown a pass, I've thrown a pass, and no one sees what we see. This is neat, dude, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, and you would have to assume the teams are going to incorporate it in some way. It's just going to be interesting to see how and in what sort of fashion each team does and how quickly, they could adapt it to them. And, especially in today's age, technology, we're always looking, the NFL is always looking for the next thing, and each team's trying to stay one step ahead of the other because it's a chess match, and you got to have that little edge that brings you over the top. And I wonder which team is going to be the first one that takes Google Glass. I would assume it's going to be a team that has a younger head coach, a younger front office that says, let's jump on this, let's get ahead of it, because, that would seem to be the way that a team would go. I would venture to guess that it will be a coach that is of the younger generation, one of the younger coaches that will jump on it and say, let's go, let's do this. And here's another thing, and we'll switch on over to baseball in general. We talked about this last week. My contention was that the no-hitter in baseball is not only becoming not a story, the novelty is worn off of it. The amount of no-hitters that we see in the past 3 years compared to the previous 10, we've had the same amount of no-hitters / perfect games in the past 3 years as we've had the past 10 years, and the novelty of it is very much wearing out. It seems like you're almost having 10 to 12 a year now with the way baseball is going. This will link into the topic of steroids and all that discussion, but it seems like I'm following Twitter all the time. It seems like 5 or 6 tweets in night, if this is what it seems like, obviously it's less than that, but our pitcher X has a no-hitter going into the 5th. Pitcher X has a no-hitter going into the 6th. When it's becoming so prevalent and so common, the fact that it is, that a pitcher got it is becoming much less of a story to me. Lincecum's one the other week was more interesting of a story because of the amount of pitches he pitched. But here's the segue in that Eric Bedard had a no-hitter going into the 7th, and he went to the coach and asked to pull himself out. And his reasoning is that he wants to pitch a few more years. He has had multiple shoulder surgeries, and that's why he pulled himself out. He was only 2/3 of the way there, and Curt Schilling reamed him for it. said no team's going to want to take him. It shows he's not a, you know, team player. He doesn't like the big moments. But I completely get it, because if you look at the list of no-hitters, most of those players are not remembered. And I would rather, as a player, be able to pitch two or three more years and be smart with what you're doing, as opposed to sitting and throwing yourself out there for the no-hitter, especially since he was already at 110 pitches.
You know, Eli, I agree. This time, you know, Eric knew his body. He's been there. He's had three shoulder surgeries. This guy's always had issues. And he didn't, you know, he knows what his limit is. That, as a manager, you want to know the future. And, you know, how can someone else who's sitting up there in the booth, you know, ream this guy? Come on, Eli, you know when you're feeling good and when you're not. I agree with what you said. And it was Schilling, right, that you said lit into him?
Oh, yeah, Curt Schilling lit into him. Oh,
man, come on, Schilling, you know better. You know you the bloody sock. Get over it, dude. Some guys know their bodies better than others. And him picking him up, I give him more props.
You know, and here's the thing. It's for sure, that's one of those things that if he would have kept himself in and given up three runs right away and lost, we would have been reaming him and saying, well, you should have taken yourself out and taken one for the team. It's complete and utter playing the result as opposed to looking at this from a good position. And I mean, with all due respect, he's in after the All-Star break for playing for the Houston Astros, who along with my Marlins are the worst team in the league. I mean, it's not like you're playing on a team late into the season going in a playoff race. He's playing for the Astros. You know, looking out for the bigger picture of not just a single game. No one would remember if it even happened. No one remembers results of single games. You know, it reminds me of Terry Francona in his book, you know, which was a phenomenal book. I really enjoyed it. If you're a baseball fan, if you're a Red Sox fan, I would highly recommend it. It's called Francona. It's the Red Sox years. Obviously, Francona is now the manager for the Cleveland Indians. But he says that, and I've read this many times from many managers, the season is simply too long for daily reaction and analysis. Yet that is what we do. But if that's so what a manager is saying, so a player could say the same thing. You know, you cannot throw it all out there for one game and risk long term, especially when the game isn't meaningful and you're in the heyday. Know your limits. Eric Bedard doesn't pitch late into games. That's not the type of pitcher that he is. He was already at 110 pitches. That is his pitching limit. I mean, it'd be stupid to stretch yourself further than that, because in all likelihood, when you know that your threshold is there and you keep yourself in, it's going to get lower, and you're fooling yourself if you say that it's not, because players know themselves and what they can do, and that's what this player has been in his career is 110, 115 pitches, and he said, and to me, did the right, complete right thing, and said, you know, I think it's time, put another guy in for me.
You know, Eli, anyone who plays a game wants to be the best at what they do. And this guy, he has a transfer no-hitter, and he pulls himself out. That's it. Schilling, shut up, dude. He knows better. That's a waste of time that Schilling actually did that. Not that I respect Schilling. And, you know, Eli, I don't know if you know my opinion, but I think pitchers nowadays are coddled way too much. But this was still a case. He threw a lot of pitches. He was in command. You know what? Just let it go. He went, what, 6 2/3 innings? Yeah, okay. You know, okay. He was ready to come out. That's all you do. You don't want him to get hurt.
Yeah, and also, it's not like it's the end of the eighth with one out left in the eighth, or the top of the ninth. He still had a sizable chunk of the game. He still had a third of the game left to go. It was, you know, the percentage of chance of him still throwing a no-hitter wasn't that much higher than if he had gone out in the fifth throwing a no-hitter. I mean, it's just stupid to ream a player for knowing what he can do and pulling himself out of a game. And like I said, especially the way that the no-hitters have gotten over the past 3 years, it is so not a novelty to me anymore that I completely get it. And, you know, I think we're going to start seeing a lot more no-hitters, especially in the days, you know, of quote unquote clean baseball, even though it seems like baseball's throwing out at us that they're clean, but we have scandal after scandal with the PEDs and, you know, Ryan Braun getting a 65-game suspension. And the rest of the year, there's talks that A-Rod's going to get a lifetime ban, even though there is no way in hell the MLB union will let that happen. And the evidence against A-Rod has yet to come forth. No, you know, everyone says they have it, they have it, they have it. There hasn't been clear indications on A-Rod. Ryan Braun obviously admitted to it, even though he didn't say it in those specific terms, but agreeing to the suspension was an admission of that. And the way that he went about it, you know, the cockiness of how he did it, as in, how dare you even question me, and then turning around and saying, you know, well, I did it. But here I want to read, and along the discussion of steroids, a good friend of mine, JC, had a great response and a post about the steroids that I felt was good enough to read. And here it is, point by point. It's a little bit lengthy, but definitely worth the time. He's a Mets fan, so you can't accuse him of loving the Yankees, loving A-Rod, and what he's about to say. Here's what he had to say, and once again, I agree with every single point. Here goes. A-Rod, love him or hate him, he has never tested positive in a legitimate test. In fact, he's a player who got screwed the most because only his name came out of supposedly anonymous testing before the collective bargaining came into effect. He was singled out because he made the most money, but people keep saying he should get more than Braun. Why? And there I completely agree with them. These name leaks before, you know, when people were clamoring so much just to have a straw, an inkling of, yes, these players aren't steroids, A-Rod got strung out to dry. Here's his second point. PEDs in general, stop acting like they cheated you somehow. You would do the same thing, and you are a liar if you say otherwise. If someone gave me a pill and said this will raise your income to $10, $20 million per year, and let's be real here, $1 million per year, you jump all over the opportunity. Here's my comment on that 100%. These players that are taking PEDs and getting better from it, and this has been my opinion all along, it doesn't take a crappy minor league player and make him into a Hall of Famer. It takes a very good player and gives him an extra boost. And with all due respect, these players are within their rights. They know what they're getting into by doing so. They're putting their body at risk in general by playing sports. So why are we drawing the line at PEDs? Them going onto the field in a professional manner is already drawing a line. So we're just randomly picking where and choose where our level of comfort is. Let's stop being hypocritical with it. Third point, Braun versus A-Rod. I touched on this above, but why would A-Rod get a lifetime ban and Braun 65 games? Baseball already admitted that 65 games was arbitrary because it was how many games were left in the season. If you want to ban A-Rod for the rest of the year, feel free. But stop acting like A-Rod did something worse than Braun. A-Rod never tried to ruin a professional's life, the testing guy he personally attacked in testimony, and he never got on TV and questioned everyone else's integrity. I know he acts like a jerk, but really, did he ever act like this much of a jerk as Braun did? And there again, exactly on the needle, Ryan Braun is getting less flack than A-Rod. Now he's getting a little bit more, but in general, he's gotten less flack than A-Rod. He's gotten the MVP in a year where he should have been suspended. He had a big screw you to the MLB when the testing went wrong and ha-ha, I got you. And it turns out he really was juicing all along. He still got the MVP that year. So let's stop with this nonsensical A-Rod should get a lifetime ban. There's absolutely no reason A-Rod should. MLB is pissed off that he's not cooperating with them. Well, grow up. You know, you're trying to screw him royally. Obviously, he's going to fight back a little. So here's another great point. The rest of the guys in the biogenesis, if you remember, before the season, there were about 20 to 30 names that came out, Gio Gonzalez amongst them, other players as well. Why is no one talking about the other 20-plus names? Because in the end, no one really cares. Throw the ball hard, hit the ball hard, catch the ball style, run fast, entertain us. As our favorite Spaniard once said, are you not entertained? Stop pretending that baseball is anything more than entertainment and move on. That's the point. These guys, and like I mentioned before, if you use PEDs, if I would get up tomorrow, start using PEDs, it would not make me into a major league player. It would not make a double-A player into a everyday starter. It would not make him into a all-star. It would not make him into a Hall of Famer. It takes a certain level of talent and bumps you up a little, which is what most of these players are doing just in various forms. So we're picking and choosing what we feel comfortable with. Let's stop it. If this player chooses to do it, get over it. It's part of what we're paying them for to entertain us. We are not paying them millions of dollars a year simply to get up in the morning, not do any other work, and just get on the field and play. There's lifting that goes on. There's training. Their schedules are ridiculous. There is so much more that we are being biased and only picking what seems to us to be uncomfortable that it's time that we stop it. And if you look every other sport, no sport is getting as much attention for their drugs and quote-unquote juicing PEDs as is baseball. Football, no one's saying anything. There's still a push for HGH, but it hasn't come through yet. And basketball, we haven't heard anything. Hockey, not. And here's the final point I will say about steroids. All this talk about steroids and why should Bonds get into the Hall of Fame or McGuire or Sosa? These guys were playing against other players who were on steroids too. They were not the only ones who were doing steroids or PEDs or juicing. These guys were playing against other players who were doing the same. So let's stop pretending like it was only one-sided and the batters were the only ones doing it. Pitchers were doing it too. And here's a crazy thought, but who says they weren't doing it 15 years ago, 20 years ago? It's just that it wasn't, hadn't come to light. Now I'm done. My rant. Roger, what's your take on steroids?
I appreciate that, Eli. There's not much that I want to add to it other than basically, there's three things. The first one is steroids really took hold back in 86, and this is a conversation that you and I can have later. I can prove it statistically to you that that's when it happened. I was around back then. The biggest joke was, it's a rabbit ball. The people in the Dominican are wrapping the ball tightly. It was all the talk of the town at the time. But that's when it really started, 86. That's when the numbers really started to take off. Home runs were flying out of the park and record numbers. Two, what about the guy that Mr. Braun got fired? That poor guy that did the drug test. He questioned his integrity, rolled him through the mud. The poor guy got fired. And three, hey, Aaron Rodgers, dude, didn't you bet your salary on the word of Ryan Braun? Didn't you say, he's such an honest guy and he leveled me that I would bet my salary? Well, I don't know, but I think it's either 3.5 million or 4 point some million. But Aaron Rodgers, I think you owe someone some money because you bet your salary that he was innocent. Gee. You know, Eli, I would have taken him up on that bet.
absolutely. There was no downside for him as far as to why. We got a lot more to talk about, and I haven't mentioned it yet, but for all you listening, thank you. And you can call in, tune in, join in on the discussion, 347-637-2306, 347-637-2306. We'll be happy to take your call, get your opinion, join in on the discussion. With that, we'll take a quick commercial break and be right back.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They were in rioters.
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.Weebly.com.
These days, my dollar just doesn't go as far. In my car, it gets me about 6 miles. On my cell phone, maybe 4 minutes. But at McDonald's, My Dollar gets me through the entire day. From sausage McMuffin with egg for breakfast to a tasty double cheeseburger. Thanks to McDonald's Dollar Menu, My Dollar gets me right where I want to be. Satisfied.
Back, thank you for tuning in. It's the Ramblings of a Diehard Sports Fan with Eli and Roger. And once again, the call in number 347-637-2306 will go to our first caller of the night, Bill, to talk to us about steroids. Bill, how you doing tonight?
Hey, good. How are you guys doing?
Good, good. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about, like I said, guys like Melky Cabrera and stuff that, you know, they're testing positive for a second time, that they might face these 100-game suspensions. What is your thought on that?
I mean, it seems like Melky Cabrera, we've already moved on from him. He got his suspension with the Giants. They flushed him out. He signed with the Blue Jays. And it seems like that's the cycle that we have with these players, is that we take the big names, we put them on the headlines, and we run it through the cycle and wait till the next player to come, and the next player, that big name that we decide to focus on, and, you know, he's left. Melky Cabrera, no one's going to remember. Cabrera served his time already. The batting title, that was controversial, and the Giants let him go. They weren't going to even have him on the playoff team, and he quietly signed, re-signed, with the Blue Jays, and, you know, he's having a pretty solid year, .277 for the Jays, so that would, to me, seem like what's going to happen. Ryan Braun will serve a suspension, he'll do it out, and as someone pointed out, you know, this year the Brewers aren't doing that well. Braun was somewhat hurt anyway. He'll sit out the year, he'll eat the 65 games, he'll eat the money that it costs him, and he'll go right on back to playing, and as soon as the next big name comes out, we'll almost forget about Ryan Braun. It would be my bet. And that seems to be the cycle that this quote-unquote steroids controversy is taking.
Right. Yeah, great point. I mean, it's just crazy that all these guys are testing positive. And I went to the doctors last week, and I tested positive for chlamydia, and boy, does it hurt.
Yeah. Well, it was going good for a few seconds there with our caller. But as always, you know, some jerks out there, and, you know, feel free to not call in next time. And, yeah, but till that last few minutes, it was going well. And like we said, you know, the steroids thing, it seems like it's, to borrow from Dan Le Batard, wash, rinse, and repeat. You know, the big names come out, and that'll be it. Here's one thing I want to start doing on our show, especially in the downtimes now. Reviews of books, sports books that I have found interesting, I've read over time. One of them here is a really good one that I really enjoyed a while back. It's called Scorecasting. It goes through various different scenarios in places that what we think is the correct approach is not the correct approach. And here's one very interesting one, especially with football coming up, that a analyst took the data from all the first quarters of the NFL games and concluded, and, you know, the reason he took from the first quarter and not the rest of the games is because at the first quarter, there is no game clock that you're really worrying about. You're not racing against the score. You're not looking, you know, special situations where you're trying to get back in the game. In the first quarter, the data he took and concluded with this data that in fourth down situations, statistically, teams are far better off for going a punt or field goal and keeping the offense on the field for another down, especially inside the opponent's 45-yard line. Facing anything less than 4th and 8, teams are better off going for it than punting. Inside the opponent's 33-yard line, they are better off going for it on anything less than 4th and 11. Regardless of field position, on anything less than 4th and 5, teams are always better off going for it. Because one of the reasons he says is that the statistical probability of keeping the ball alive and keeping your team on the field is greater than what you gain by punting because of the shorter distances that you really make up, especially with a big gain. But also you have the emotional aspect of it, that if your team stays on the field and converts a fourth down, it gives your offense a boost and it shuts, you know, it gives the defense is deflated a little. And there have been high school coaches, obviously it's not at the pro level, who have done nothing but go for it every single fourth down and have been successful with it. And it's incredibly interesting that in the NFL, where even though it's statistically been proven, coaches will not do it just because the way it's been done all the time is you punt for it on fourth down. And, you know, that, to me, I would love to see coaches start going for it on fourth down a lot more because of the potential gain that you have. The upside to going for it on fourth down is higher than when you punt or go for the field goal. But as this book points out a lot, people as a whole, every single person, we are risk averse. You would rather play it safe and not lose the risk rather than gamble and go for the advantage. We want to minimize the losses as opposed to looking at the potential gain. People would much rather not make a dollar than lose a dollar, even though, you know, it makes no sense, but that's the way it is. People are risk averse, and it comes through especially in the NFL with punting and kicking and, you know, scorecasting by John Wortham and Tobias Moskowitz. I would definitely highly recommend it. And one of the things he goes through in there is the statistical breakdown of coaches benching their players with 5 fouls, how, you know, it doesn't make sense. And other things like that, where, you know, the goes through home court advantage, proving that it exists, but not for the reasons that you think. There are many, many great examples in this book. If you've read any other books like Freakonomics, books along those nature, Malcolm Gladwell stuff, this is very much along the lines, but within sports. So for all you listening out there, highly recommend the book Scorecasting by John Wertheim and Tobias Moskowitz. And, you know, there are many, many great sports books out there that if you're not reading them, you are definitely missing out. Anything by John Feinstein is highly recommended. And the owners of the Tampa Bay Rays were looked at in a book called The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. And that goes through the philosophy of the Rays front office right now and how they have the team where they are, competitive year in and year out, even though they're at the bottom of the barrel with salary cap, especially in the division that the top of the team, the top teams in that division are higher, much higher up on the salary cap, with the Yankees and the Red Sox spending a lot more than the Rays, and yet the Rays are still competitive. And so The Extra 2% is a great book. You know, in it they mention how pretty much once a pitcher hits 30, they are going to dump them. They're not going to extend their big-name pitchers. They trade and get very good value for them. And they trust in their process. They trust what they're doing. And it really worked out because we see year in and year out, they are competitive on a very minimal salary, doing what they're doing. You know, letting players go, letting big pitchers go. They let B.J. Upton go this year, and still they were competitive. That, and they hold to what the studies of Bill James and along the likes of, that in the mid-20s, 26, 27 is when players peak, and they do not hold on to players for longer than that. That is when they trade them, and still, shockingly, they're able to get value four of those players, you would think by now baseball would have stopped taking their calls and just said, we're not going to make trades with you, Tampa Bay, because we know what you got up your sleeve. But you always have to take that risk. You know, you have teams looking to take that risk, even though they know they're going to get fleeced because they're closer to the end of the season. They're in the playoff race. So the Rays take advantage of that. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier in the year with the Marlins and their trade. When everyone was up in arms, the Marlins should have never spent the money that they did on the players. You spend minimal amounts of money. You build from within. You build the foundation in. And that's what this year is spent on doing. You have a lot of very good young players on the team who are maturing at a big league level. Jose Fernandez has been a great story. You have Christian Yelich, who was called up this week, went 3-for-3 in his debut. First Marlins player to do that since current manager Mike Redmond about 20 years ago. So, you know, teams like that in the smaller market that are not big payroll teams consistently, that's what they need to do, build a foundation. So the book, The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First by Jonah Carey and Mark Cuban, is a very, very good read. Highly recommend. And, you know, it sheds light on some of the philosophies of what the Rays have done, how they're putting themselves in position to do what they have done, and it sheds a lot of light on it. And to me, it was a very worth the time reading. And let's get back to Sarah's for 1 second. I don't know, did you see, Roger, the quote? And it's a money quote by Logan Morris and the Marlins first baseman when they, you know, Brian Braun got suspended yesterday or the day before, and they asked Logan Morrison about it. What was Logan Morrison's response? You know, we're clean. We haven't scored a run in 37 innings. The Marlins went through that stretch that weekend of not scoring at all. So, you know, and there's mixed feelings amongst baseball people. John Rocker came out and said it, that baseball should go back to steroids because it was a funner, more exciting game. And you know what? I'm almost want to agree with that because you did. The offense was more productive then. So, you know, you have people who have both sides of the coin. And as you mentioned, you saw baseball beforehand and you saw it during steroids, and now you're hearing the downside of it, or what baseball wants to say is the downside of it. So what's your take on that?
You know, Eli, there's no doubt there are fewer players on steroids right now. I mean, it's pretty clear. But are they still going to dope? Of course they are. You asked that question based on what your buddy said. If you would take a pill and you could earn $1 million, someone asked me that question because Eli, I played high school baseball. I was fortunate. I was one of the lucky guys. But what kept me out of baseball was I didn't throw 96 miles an hour. If I could have taken a pill that would have gotten me to 93, 94, I would have taken it. If there was a shot, I would have taken it. And it's just, you know, you do what you do to continue. And, you know, I'm not going to condone what the players are doing. It is against the rules right now. But maybe it's something that we need to, you know, the fans should have an opinion in it. And I think they do, Eli, by the attendance. The attendance hasn't been changed all that much. This year is down for whatever reason. I don't know. But in the last 10 years, baseball has set attendance records. So that's with the steroids and without the steroids. We've got to find out what the fans really want, Eli. And we know the sports writers of today are against it. But looking at the numbers, it's kind of hard to even wonder if the fans care whether they're on steroids or not.
Yeah, I mean, you get seeming outrage from fans when players are named and when the big star's named and how, you know, we can't have it and this and that. But it would seem like overall the fans don't really care that much. And I would venture to say most baseball fans would rather be entertained in the way they were with the steroids age than the way it is now with the pitching matchups, where it takes a real baseball purist to really enjoy those pitching duels, the pitching matchups on a night-to-night basis. I think the fan base in general as a whole would much prefer the steroid era baseball that we had, and the high offense, home runs, balls out of the park, deeper balls into the outfield, making the outfielders run a little more, play a little more. So that would be my gut, is that that's what the fans want, is to go back to when there were steroids. And here's a little bit of a different topic, but we'll switch over to it. And I was reading ESPN magazine, and they had the body issue where they were showing different quotes from players. And in it, John Wall was quoted as saying, "When I was 16, I got cut from my team. It has driven me and given me a purpose." Now, it seems like you have that often with basketball players or with football players, with baseball players, hockey players. Well, they'll come out and say, you know, "I went through a rough time in high school, college, whatever, where I got cut. I went through a hard time, and you know, or another person mocked me, and it really drove me." Now, here's my thing, and it's complete hindsight bias in that we're looking and playing the result. Because, you know, for every one guy like John Wall who made it to the pros and is able to say that, I guarantee you there are 1,200, 1,500, if not more, people who had that same exact experience and are sitting on the couch with a beer belly and a gut and sitting at the remote watching John Wall play. So we're looking at the one or two people and trying to glorify them for, oh, look at the drive this guy has. Look at how the failure motivated him. But we're not looking at all those other failures of people who had the same exact experience and it didn't do squat for them. And it's playing complete hindsight bias, which we do all the time in sports.
I agree, Eli. I agree with that, dude.
You know, and it's you know, the same thing could be said, and I know it's an extreme example, but Jordan always talks about how he didn't make the high school team and how it motivated him and made him try to get better. And, you know, for him, maybe it did a little, but how much of that is him just looking for a reason to motivate himself and not really being a reason, whereas you have so many players who also got cut and it doesn't do anything for them, or so, you know, a lot of people have had down experiences. And if you need to go to that to say that this is what motivated me, you know, it's very easy to say after the fact, when in reality, that was just one little small part of what it was. And it just makes, you know, it seems phony in a way to me when players come out and say that, because you know what? Everyone's motivated by something. You happen to be motivated by getting cut. You know, who really cares? You know, that was, I don't know. It just seems, it doesn't seem like it should really make much of a difference what motivates a person as far as what their drive is to play professional ball.
Yeah, you know what, Eli? Everyone has their motivation, man. And it depends what it could be, whether you are cut, whether it's the desire to just be the best. I mean, some guy, look, Kobe Bryant, good or bad, you know, he said he is the best and he wants to be the best. He wants to win. Same thing with LeBron. Come on. LeBron wants to win. Much as he's disliked, you cannot blame him for wanting to win. As a matter of fact, that's great that you actually see someone with that fervor, with that desire, you know? That's a good thing.
Yeah. And talking about players saying they're the best, Derrick Rose came out and said he's the best player in the NBA. And I'm going to take, here's my approach to this. And you know what? Bulls fans are going to laud him for saying it. They're going to love him saying it. But when other players on other teams, and every sports fan does it, says it, you know, they're being cocky, they're being this. And I guarantee you, you will not hear that from a single Bulls fan. And my take on that is, good for, I don't care that he said it. You know what? I happen to disagree with it. But if he thinks he's the best, you know, he hasn't played in, God, it seems like 5 years, but he hasn't played in a year and a half almost, and he's been out, but to come out and say he's the best player, fine. If that's what you think, fine. It's a level of cockiness, a level of, you know, we as sports fans don't like it because it's not humble. To me, I don't have a problem with it. Dwayne Wade, you know, he didn't say he's the best, but you had a similar transition where he was this quiet player coming out of Marquette playing for the Heat. They had success early on in the playoffs. He took them a few rounds in when no one expected him to be a great player. And as time has gone on, we have seen him get more cocky, more having a lot more hubris on the court, and everyone knocks him for it. And especially for me personally, I've had discussions with Bulls fans who have told me he needs to get a little bit, you know, humble. And, you know, you never see Derrick Rose doing this, and this is last year. And I told him, I promise you one thing, just wait. It's coming from Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose just hasn't been around long enough for it to happen, and I've been proven right. It has come with Derrick Rose. You have it with the superstars. That's by nature what they are going to do. And if you look at the ESPN ran a poll, and it doesn't shock you, is Derrick Rose the best player? And the only state that agreed with that was Illinois, because everyone else realizes that Derrick Rose is not the best player. Maybe if he's playing healthy in a full year, you could have the discussion and argument about it. Coming off the injury transition and the time that he has been and sitting out when people thought he should be playing, you definitely cannot make that argument. But I don't have a problem with him coming out and saying it. My problem is with the people who thought that Derrick Rose would never say such a thing because he is not cocky like that and he is humble and this and that. Players like that who are in the media and who are very good players get there. They grow into that stage. We've seen it with all the players. Kevin Durant at one point said he's frustrated with being number two behind LeBron and not being able to be good enough. And Derrick Rose is now saying he's the best. You have it with all the superstars, which I don't have. As I said, I don't have a problem with it. My only problem has been, and I've pointed out before, people deluding themselves into thinking that it should be any other way. These guys who are making those statements are legitimately at the top of their field. Why shouldn't they be allowed to say that I am one of the better players in the league? I am the best. I view myself as being the best. I deserve it. You know what? Humility is not denying what you are. It's going about it and not letting it get to your head. Some of them obviously do, but to sit there and say that they have no right to say it, you know what? These guys are LeBron, Kobe, Rose when he's healthy, Durant. These guys are the best of the best. You know, there
Flacco.
Are thousands. For sure, Flacco. I mean, all these guys who think that they are, you know what? When you played up to it, you have a right to say it. Even though the fan base as a whole, when it's not on your team, you have never seen a guy who, when his guy on his team is saying that, is yelling and screaming, you have no right to say that. No, when it's guys on our team, we're happy and ecstatic for it. When it's guys on another team, we jump on them right away. And I don't have a problem with it. These guys are legitimately at the top of the list. You know, it is a little bit ironic that Derrick Rose is coming out and saying it at this point when he hasn't played for a while and what sat out for longer than what he should have, according to most people. That's the only interesting point to me, where he's saying it and at what point and stage he's saying it. You know, it's not in the middle of the NBA season when he's returning and the Bulls are on a run. It's in the off season when he hasn't played in a while and when arguably the best player in the league, LeBron James, who's coming off two straight championships, two straight MVPs and finals MVPs, that's the interesting part to me, to saying that he's the best player. But I don't have a problem with the thought behind the statement of he has a right to make that statement. Most people don't agree with that. I completely agree with that. If you're at the top of your game, go right ahead and say it. You know, obviously, if Luol Deng would come out and say that, it would be laughed away. But Derrick Rose, you know, when Derrick Rose makes that statement, it's a legitimate topic of discussion. You know, at the point that he said it, I disagree with. But if he would have said this when he's completely healthy, it would have been a legitimate discussion. Guys that are lower down, we wouldn't even waste our time with. But Derrick Rose, it is a legitimate discussion as to whether he could be considered the best player in the league.
Yes, Eli, it is legitimate. Anyone who says that. But I got to tell you, he hasn't played. What have you done for me lately? Look, I am not a LeBron fan. I never will be. But, dude, the best guy in the league right now, if you want to have the argument, is LeBron. And I'm a baseball guy, dude. Well, I'm a football, baseball before, and basketball, and even I saw that LeBron is better. I watched the finals. I had nothing to do but watch the finals.
Yeah, and, you know, as Roger pointed out, you know, obviously everyone yells at me because I've got a bias as a Heat fan, But LeBron James has statistically proven and shown, especially in the performance, when everyone kept saying he's not clutch, he's not clutch, he's not clutch. Well, he's shown him differently. Derrick Rose, maybe. You want to have that discussion? Let's have it when you're healthy and taking your team somewhere, not when you're coming off a injury-riddled year where you didn't play and sat out longer than most people thought you should. Have that discussion when you're healthy and your team's on a run, not when your team went to the playoffs without you and won in a round and got knocked off by the Heat. Let's have the discussion when you're healthy and when there's actually something to talk about, as opposed to in the middle of the offseason when there's nothing else going on, when you haven't played for a year and a half. Now is not the time to make a statement like that. Get your butt back on the court, become something, a go-to guy for your team again, and not be riddled by injuries, and then let's have the discussion about whether you are the best player in the league or not. And here's one final thought. We're wrapping up this week's edition of Rambling of the Diehard Sports Fan. The thing that everyone's been harping on and will not shut, it will not go away till LeBron re-signs with a team or signs with another team. The discussion of where LeBron is going to go, a lot of players and people have speculated that the Lakers are a destination for him, for Carmelo, and for other big names. And they're hyping this fantasy of the Lakers have all this cap space, and the reality of it, as Pro Basketball Talk has pointed out, is that it's not the case. They will not have nearly as much money as people expect, so that even if they have the ability to sign LeBron and Carmelo, the cap space will not be there for them. And the fantasy of the Lakers and the Lakers fan base of what they could do hits the reality, hits the wall of their cap exceptions and what they will not be able to do, even if they are in a position where they could sign them. So the talk of the Lakers and Kobe coming out and saying he can see LeBron going to them, people reporting that Carmelo Anthony might go out to the Lakers and sign with them, for them it is going to be a lot harder of a cap reality to sign than what people are making it out to be. So it's not going to be nearly as simple as Lakers fans hope. And even that's the case, you know, that's assuming that these players actually want to sign with them. The Lakers, if they don't get these two guys, which you're hoping will sign and take a turnaround, the Lakers team is in for a long haul rebuilding, because Kobe is going to demand another, you know, contract. He's still got a few more years, but you're going to have to pieces around him and make it so that his last few years are something worthwhile. And right now, this year, it doesn't look like they're going to be able to compete. But the problem is the fantasy that the Lakers have of what will happen with their team. It's almost like the Knicks had with the offseason where Carmelo got traded to them, where they're going to get Carmelo, they're going to get Amare. People thought, you know, for a while they were talking, oh, let's get Dwight Howard next season. The idea of it is great, the cap reality, not so much. And that's the problem with a lot of this talk in sports, when you talk about the fantasy of what you hope to happen, and then you look at the reality of it, and that it just doesn't compute. You know, teams have cap specialists, and that's what it was. You know, Pat Riley, when he went ahead and went for the big three, got rid of the entire roster. If they would not have gotten those three, you would have had a roster of guys who shouldn't be in the NBA playing for them, because there was no one else on the league. So that's going to be the thing to watch, not only where LeBron's leading to, but the cap realities of what the Lakers are facing. And that is what to watch out for. Thank you all for joining us. Have a good week. Talk to you later. Bye. Tune in next week, Wednesday night, 10:30 to 11:30, with Eli and Izzy for Ramblings of a Diehard Sports Fan. Adios.